your silence is commanded.
Seated. Good afternoon. We are here to hear the third case, 05AP0544, Daimler Chrysler v. Lerck. Representing Daimler Chrysler is Thomas M. Is it Roche or Roche? Counsel? Let me go through it. Lerck is represented by Jeffrey Shampo, and Glenn May is represented by Richard Fortune. Each of you will share 30 minutes equally, and you, counsel, have 25 minutes and 5 in rebuttal. You may proceed.
May it please the Court. I am Tom Roy of Kasdorf, Lewis & Sweetlick, representing Daimler Chrysler, the plaintiff's appellants in this matter. The initial question before this Court is whether an award of permanent partial disability that is higher than any estimate by a practitioner, which is in evidence, is permitted under Section 102.18.1d of the Wisconsin statutes if the award is based on an administrative code minimum under DWD 80.32 of the Wisconsin Administrative Code. Section 102.18.1d states, any award which falls within a range of 5% of the highest or lowest estimate of permanent partial disability made by a practitioner, which is in evidence, is presumed to be a reasonable award, provided it is not higher than the highest or lower than the lowest estimate in evidence. This statute defines the limits of the Commission's discretion as it pertains to permanent partial disability awards. It is very specific.
Mr. Roy, I want to slow you down right there. As I heard you read the statute talks in terms of a presumption of reasonableness of the awards. I don't hear anything in the language of the statute that suggests limits on the awards. So if you could flesh out why this would be a limit.
The reason why there's a limit, Your Honor, is that if you allow the Commission to go beyond the ranges that are specifically listed in the statute has no meaning at all.
Isn't the meaning of the statute that it loses its presumption of reasonableness?
Well, let's put it in a context. In 1979, this Court decided the Pfister case. And in Pfister, basically what happened is that the doctors came in with estimates of 5% and 15%. The department awarded 20%. And this Court decided that the award was not based on substantial and credible evidence in the record. And in doing so, they specifically disavowed the notion that there was a 5% leeway in permanent partial disability awards. Section 102.18.1d was enacted in response to that decision. And when it enacted that statute, it basically said, look, we're going to allow this range of permanent partial disability awards to be presumed to be reasonable. Now, the administrative code minimums that are in existence today were in existence in 1980. And if the court wanted to make some, or I'm sorry, if the legislature wanted to make some kind of exception for the administrative code minimums, they would have done so when they drafted Section 102.18.1d. They did not do so.
But don't we have to look at what the legislature, in fact, did do? And when I read the language, and that's why I'm trying to get you to focus on and why it's a limit, when I read the language of the statute, what I see here is, okay, we've got a presumption area here. And if you're outside of the area, there's no presumption. And you're reading that a little bit more broadly than that to say, no, this is a limit. And you can't go beyond this.
Well, the statute modified Pfister. And Pfister was very clear and specific in saying that there is no leeway from the medical estimates and evidence. So essentially what you've got is The statute comes in and says we're going to allow this much discretion. But Pfister still applies. Pfister was not overruled. It was modified. And so they're enacting a statute in a context where they know that the commission will not have the authority to go beyond the ranges specified because that's what Pfister said. And Pfister remains binding precedent. So when they enact this language, they're fully aware that the commission and department are not going to have the authority to go beyond these ranges. They want to give them a little more discretion than this court did in 1979. But they were very specific in saying, provided it is not higher than the highest or lower than the lowest estimate in evidence. And what could the legislature possibly have meant by the language, provided it is not higher than the highest or lower than the lowest estimate in evidence, if it is acceptable to exceed these limits? We all know that statutes are not to be construed in a manner or will be construed in a manner which will avoid a construction that makes a word or phrase superfluous.
It seems to me that your construction renders superfluous is presumed to be. Doesn't it seems to me that your construction would is essentially that the evidence is a reasonable award, provided that it's not higher than the highest and lowest and the lowest.
It's true. It does create a presumption of reasonableness, but it does so in a context in which it's very specific in what it limits. And when they state that provided it is not higher than the higher or lowest than lowest estimate in evidence, that's a legislative intention. That's a message to us.
I think I'm not making myself clear. It's my fault, not yours. It seems to me that your reading of the statute takes out of the statute the word, or arguably takes out of the statute the words presumed to be. Your reading of the statute seems to me to say, hey, look, if it falls within a 5% range, as long as it's not 5% higher than the highest or 5% lower than the lowest, it is a reasonable award. Isn't that what you're saying the statute means?
What I'm saying is that the statute was intended to create a certain range of permanent partial disability awards that were permissible. Because this court in Pfister found no variation from the medical evidence, estimates and evidence to be permissible. So the statute's enacted to that and saying, well, we're going to modify what the court has done here. We're going to allow this range to take place.
Because it's reasonable.
Because
5%
it's reasonable.
Deviation is reasonable.
That's
Come on.
Correct.
You know, who can tell with precision? Give me a break. You know, so 5% is reasonable.
That's
right?
Correct.
So if 5% deviation is reasonable, as long as it's not 5% higher than the highest and lowest than the lower, lower than the lowest, then why do you need the words is presumed to be? What does that mean other than there's a presumption going on?
Because this court had basically indicated that such a variance was not presumed to be reasonable. And so the legislature is responding to that. And that's why they used the language presumed to be reasonable. I mean, could they have used different language? Sure. But they also could have used language that allowed an exception for administrative code minimums that were in existence in 1980, and they failed to do so. And I think that that's very significant in this case. In addition to the Pfister decision, which we believe to be directly on point, there are a whole series of Supreme Court decisions that make clear that the Commission needs medical evidence to base medical findings of fact. In West Bend versus Lurk, the Court held that if an employee makes a claim for permanent partial disability, quote, certainly some supporting expert and competent medical testimony would be expected, end of quote. 149 was second at 130. On pages 21 through 24 of our initial brief, we cite 10 published decisions for the basic proposition that findings of fact of medical questions must be based upon medical evidence in the record. Under any standard of review, an agency interpretation is not only to be reversed if it directly contravenes the language of the statute, it also must be reversed if it is inconsistent, quote, with judicial analysis of the statute, end of quote.
Counsel, I just had the opportunity to go over the Pfister case that you were citing. I looked at it a while ago, but I look at it now for the words that you suggest are in Pfister, that this Court presumed that it wasn't and that you needed the words presumed that it is reasonable. I don't find that language in the Pfister case, that the Court presumed. It might be there, because I just did a quick read. Are you able to?
They don't have, I don't think they have the language presumed to be, Your Honor. Basically, if you look at the Pfister decision, what you've got is a number of issues going on in that case. And essentially what happens is the case comes before the Court with a 20% PPD rating found by the Department, although none of the medical records indicate 20%. So the first thing that the Court does when they look at that is they say, well, first of all, there's a mistake here because there's no medical records saying 20%. And what happened is that the commission or department back then and the circuit court believed there was a 5% leeway in permanent partial disabilities based upon the Supreme Court's decision in Paulzien, which took place in 1957, which left the impression that there was a 5% leeway. And this court in 1979 in Pfister basically said that we hereby disavow that. We do not believe there's a 5% leeway. So the unmistakable implication there is that you are limited to the medical estimates given by the doctors. Now, there's some other evidence, issues in there dealing with loss of earning capacity, which really aren't relevant to the issues before the court today. But as far as the medical evidence for permanent partial disability, they're basically stating that you have no leeway. And that's the way I read the Pfister decision. So when the legislature responds to that.
I read the decision that way, too. I just heard your answer as I was making inquiry why, whether or not you were reading out the phrase is presumed to be in the statutes. You said no, that they, I heard you say no, that they had to put in is presumed to be reasonable in response to the Pfister opinion, which said it is presumed to be unreasonable. I mean, okay. That's what I heard you say, and that's why I was
Could they have used different language in 102.181d? Certainly. But if we look at the language as it exists, and we look at the context in which it was enacted, I think it's unmistakable that the legislature knew that they were modifying Pfister, that they were not overruling Pfister. They could have overruled it. They could have just said, you know, if it's reasonable, we're going to approve it regardless of what the doctors say. But they didn't do that. They basically indicated that permanent partial disability would be defined based upon the medical estimates of practitioners and evidence. And so that's what they're using. And they basically used the word presumed to be reasonable, I think, to allow that range of discretion. But I don't see anything in Section 102.18.1d that would suggest or imply that they can go beyond that.
Counsel, let me ask you about that, because you do have Dr., I believe his name is pronounced, Ansari's testimony regarding the two procedures that were done on the knee, the one that showed a 15% partial permanent disability, and then the second surgery where he came in and he said 10% partial permanent disability. So I want to ask you about your read of DWD 80.32, where the rule provides minimum percentages of loss of use for amputation levels, losses of motion, sensory losses, and surgical procedures. It doesn't use the term surgical procedure. It uses procedures plural. Now, as you read that rule, is it your position that the two procedures that were done here really amount, for the purposes of this case, to one, and therefore only Ansari's latter testimony controls, or can, as I think opposing counsel argues here, can they stack that based upon the multiple procedures that were done under this rule?
I argue that they cannot stack it, and I guess we're shifting over now to the interpretation of the administrative code as opposed to what I believe to be a contravention of the statute itself. The administrative code provision, subsection 1 of 80.32, says that any pre-existing disability is to be deducted from the minimums, and that the minimums presume that the joint was previously without disability.
But my understanding of the facts, and that's why I wanted to focus in on the language of the rule, is that you don't have multiple disabilities here. You have one disability to the knee, but you have multiple surgeries for
that. That's correct, Your Honor. So I think what this rule is basically telling us is that there is a minimum of 10% permanent partial disability at the knee for an ACL repair, but that presumes that that knee was previously without disability. And I think when you state the minimums apply when the surgery takes place. So it's previously without disability means previous to that surgery. And I think what you see is you see some very inconsistent decisions coming out of the commission. You basically see at least three decisions that we cite in our briefs in Roche, Schaefer, and King, where they specifically deduct a pre-existing surgery from a subsequent surgery on the knee. And yet we have two cases, one of which is the one before the court today, and one of which is the Hellendrunk case, where they say you've got to add the surgeries as far as the minimums. And I guess they ask for controlling weight, and my question is, what interpretation is this court supposed to give controlling weight to, the one that appears before the court today or the one that appears before the court next month or in 6 months or in 12 months?
Counselor, if I understand your argument, though, under the statute, there isn't any physician testimony for 25% or for 20%. So you would be, if your statutory argument is correct, interpreting 8032 contrary to the statutes to get a stack, right?
That's correct.
Physician testimony.
That's correct, Your Honor. Basically, the statute, I believe, is very specific. And I think it's also the case law that has come down over the years is very specific, that you do need a doctor's opinion for permanent partial disability for there to be substantial and credible evidence of that permanent partial disability. And the administrative code minimums cannot take the place of medical evidence that is in the record. And so, ultimately, it's not our position that DWD 80.32 is invalid. We're not asking that be knocked out of the administrative code. As the Court of Appeals has instructed, quote, we should, if at all possible, construe regulations to harmonize them with any applicable statute, end of quote.
Counsel, can I ask, and I may have not gleaned this from your brief, you may already have it in there, but you made an argument a moment ago that disability should be read to mean each surgery. And I'm just wondering, do you have any case law to support that proposition that each surgery constitutes a separate disability as opposed to the disability being the injury to the knee with multiple surgeries?
Actually, I think we must have a misunderstanding. It's our position that there's one disability to the joint, there's one minimum for that particular joint, and when you come up with an event that causes a minimum, that minimum presumes, according to subsection 1 of DWD 80.32, that the joint was previously without disability. So in this case, if we're going to apply the administrative code, we're going to look first at the first surgery. It's 10% minimum for the ACL repair. He really didn't have a very good result, if you look at the record. He undergoes the second surgery. He has a much, much better result, and both the applicant in his testimony and also Dr. Ansari agreed with that. And Dr. Ansari looks at that and says, this second surgery does not justify an increase in the permanent partial disability rating. And I think that's consistent with the administrative code, because that administrative code, when that second surgery takes place, yes, there's a 10% minimum that attaches to that, but that 10% minimum presumes that the member was previously without disability. And in fact,
where was the previous disability? That's what I'm trying to get
you to. The previous disability was with the first surgery, Your Honor.
That's what I'm trying to get you to answer the question to. Do you have any cases that support the proposition that that first surgery would constitute a separate disability as opposed to the knee injury constituting the disability?
Actually, it's part of the knee disability. Is there any particular published case on it? I don't believe so, because I don't believe there's any published cases on DWD 80.32 in general.
Thank you.
So,
but could I ask you, is this a statutory interpretation case?
Yes, it is.
And when you go to 102.18.1D, don't we first look at the language of that?
You're absolutely correct, Your Honor. We look at the language first. And if the language is clear, you do not have to go beyond the language. And our position is that, first of all, the language is clear. If Section 102.18.1D means anything at all, It's got to mean that the commission is indeed bound by the ranges that are very specifically set forth in that statute. If the commission is allowed to go beyond those ranges whenever they find a reason to do so, it has no effect at all. It has no meaning at all, and basically has no effect at all on how the commission conducts its business. And so, since we're not supposed to construe even a word or phrase in a statute to be superfluous, we certainly don't want to construe that entire section to be superfluous. And I'll add that when I talk about the context in which Section 102.18.1d is enacted, I'm stating not only is the language clear, but the context is also clear, and that our position is not only supported by the language, but it's supported by the context in which the language was enacted and the history, the fact that Pfister was decided in 1979 and this statute was a response to Pfister.
It would seem to me, with all possible respect, the best argument that you could make to me is that this subsection D is ambiguous, could mean more than one thing. And then I could go beyond that, and I'm not sure I'm seeing the documentation that the legislature had exactly the interpretation you intend here.
Well, I think when you're dealing with a Supreme Court decision that says you've got no leeway whatsoever, and they come up with a statute that says we're going to presume that it's reasonable if you vary it by 5%, as long as it's not higher than the highest or lower than the lowest estimate in evidence. What's happening there is, if indeed the language, quote, presumed to be reasonable, end of quote, means what the defendants seem to indicate that it means, why would the legislature have bothered to include a 5% range? Why would the legislature have bothered to include the language provided it is not higher than the highest or lower than the lowest estimate in evidence?
For the purposes of this case at this point, what is the evidence?
The evidence was Mr. May had an injury to his...
What is the percentage in evidence? Is it 15%?
The percentage in evidence is 10%. What happened is that in April of 2001, Dr. Ansari initially opined 15% permanent partial disability for the first procedure, which included not only an ACL repair but also medial meniscus repair.
What I'm trying to get at is, suppose Lurk had awarded 15%. Wouldn't that conform to your interpretation of the statute?
It would, Your Honor. And in fact, 15% is in the record. Dr. Ansari does give 15%, and I believe the commission does have the authority to take an earlier opinion of a physician over a later opinion of a physician. It's all a matter of credibility. So had they awarded 15% and say, gee, Dr. Ansari gave 15% on that day, we find that more credible than the 10% he gave later, there would have been substantial credible evidence in the record for that finding.
Okay, so is it possible to read this subsection D that an award of 25 or 20 is simply not presumed to be correct?
Well, in all honesty, if you read it that way, Your Honor, then what effect does that subsection even have? If the commission can just say, well, we're going to find 20% on this case or 25% on this case because we think it's reasonable.
Well, I think the effect would be the commission better darn well have evidence to substantiate 20 or 25%.
And that's something that they do not have here. All they really have here is Dr. Ansari saying 10%. Earlier he says 15%. The precedents that we cite from this court basically states that you need medical evidence for medical findings of fact, and an administrative code provision cannot overrule a statute. And basically, again, in the context of when the legislature is enacting 102.18.1d, they're starting from a starting point where there is no leeway permitted, period. And in that context, they state, well, we're going to presume that this range is reasonable. Their intention, they know that if they go beyond those ranges that they specify in 102.18.1d, that it's not going to be permitted, because that's what this court found in Pfister. Pfister was not overruled by Section 102.18.1d. It was simply modified. And I think Pfister is still binding, and it's our position that Pfister is the positive of this case.
If I could, your answer to Justice Prosser raised a different issue that maybe I misheard you. I want to make sure I didn't mishear you. Did you, just in response to Justice Prosser, indicate that the commission can go back and look at the earlier doctor testimony, which would have been 15%? And if that, in fact, was done in applying the statute, any award that falls... I'm sorry, so it's not higher than that. I got it. Never mind. Just wanted to make sure. Yes. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, that would get you to 15, but it wouldn't get you to the 20. All right. I just wanted to make sure that we have a reason to have this case.
Your position is that the evidence in the record is 10%, and at best they could go to 15%.
That's
correct. When I ask these folks, what is the evidence in the record, the top evidence in the record, what are they going to say?
Well, they're going to state, I can only go on what they've stated in previous proceedings before the Court of Appeals. And they basically indicated that the surgical procedures themselves are credible and substantial evidence for the permanent partial disability. And the problem with that, of course, is that they're going beyond the statute to the administrative code. Again, the administrative code minimums were in existence in 1980. If the legislature had truly intended that the commission could go beyond the range to the administrative code to make an independent award based solely upon the evidence, solely upon the administrative code minimums themselves, they could have specified that, but they failed to do so. And the administrative code cannot give the commission the authority, which this court in Pfister and which section 102.18.1d prohibits them.
Thank you.
And I believe I'm out of time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. We'll next hear from Attorney Jeffrey J. Champeau, who represents LURC. Counsel?
May it please the Court, my name is Jeffrey Champeau, and I represent the Labor and Industry Review Commission. I'd like to start off by answering Justice Butler's question about preexisting disability. DWD 8032 sub 1 says that an appropriate deduction should be made for preexisting disability. And that language tracks a Court of Appeals case, which itself tracks a Supreme Court case that says that an employer should not have to pay compensation for a pre-existing disability that can be separated from the effects of a later work injury. And what that means in the context of this case is that you can make a deduction for pre-existing disability, but only if it can be separated from the later work injury. If it comes into effect after the work injury, it's not a pre-existing disability. I'd like to try and answer another question, too, that was raised, or a point that Mr. Roy was making, and that is that there's no authority for the minimums and that the legislature could have put that into 102.18.1d. In fact, if you look at 102.32 sub 6, now that's the statute, it says that if compensation can be determined based on the minimums in the administrative code, that the compensation is supposed to be paid within a certain number of days. And then in subsection C, I think it distinguishes awards that are based on doctor's ratings or evidence from doctors. So this section itself contemplates an award based on the minimums in the administrative code. Now, it came into effect after Mr. May's injury in this case. And so we're not saying that Daimler-Chrysler had to pay the compensation within any particular period of time. But what we're saying is you can look at that section of the statutes and see that the legislature understands that the commission makes awards based on these code minimums. Now, Mr. Roy says that that's inappropriate to make that argument, but the fact is the Supreme Court itself has looked at subsequent legislation to determine what an earlier version of the statute meant. And the citation for that would be McGarity versus Welch Plumbing at 104 WIS 2D 414 427. There's some other cases listed in there as well.
Counsel, I might be wrong. My understanding is that one of the reasons that there are scheduled injuries and that there are minimums for certain procedures or certain percentage of loss of arm or whatever is that is if there's no claim, let's say the claimant doesn't go out and hire an attorney. Let's say that the claimant has a a prosthesis in the knee. And doesn't go out, and that's 50%. That's what the scheduled injury is. And doesn't go out and have his doctor or a different doctor say, okay, I know it's 50%, but we're going to add a little on and get 60 or 75. That the insurance company then, if there's no medical evidence, the insurance company has to pay. The medical evidence is a work-related injury is causation, but not with regard to percentage. Then the insurance company pays what the schedule says is the very minimum. And so that is paid regardless of any doctor's report that says percentage. And that's one of the reasons for these scheduled injuries, to set a floor that even if they don't have any doctor's report that says it's higher and higher and higher, this is the floor the insurance company has to pay as a minimum for that type of scheduled injury. Am I correct or incorrect?
That's the way it works.
That's the way it's worked for a long time in workers' comp.
Right. And the question here is what happens if a doctor's rating comes in below the floor or below what the commission determines the floor is supposed to be. And our position is that 102.18.1d really doesn't deal with that situation. That statute deals with the situation where an award is based on a doctor's estimate, not based on a minimum disability rating. And that the statutes recognize that the commission can base awards on the minimum disability estimates, that in fact there are other rules that have been approved by the Supreme Court where the commission has made permanent partial disability awards based on administrative code provisions. That would be the hearing loss rule at 8026, DWD 8026, and the vision rule at 8025. I think I got those reversed. Hearing loss is 8025, vision is 8026. But in both of those cases, permanent partial disability is based on a formula set out in the administrative code. And in the Moen case, the Supreme Court said that was fine with respect to vision loss. And in the Harnischweger case, the Supreme Court said that was fine with respect to hearing loss. And what DWD 8032 is just a similar rule that sets out a minimum.
Mr. Shampo, let me ask you the same question I asked Mr. Roy. In looking at DWD 8032, is it Lurk's position that preamble, the minimum percentages of loss of use for amputation levels, losses of motion, sensory losses, and surgical procedures means that assuming that there's no pre-existing disability separate from this injury, that for every surgical procedure, the mandatory minimum would kick in at 10%?
Yes. And Mr. Roy says we've been inconsistent on that point. In fact, when you look at the cases, what we've done is we've had cases where there has been a pre-existing disability, a work injury, and then another surgery. And consistent with the Siemens case and the Green Bay Soap case, we've made the deduction. This is a case where Mr. May had a healthy knee. He had an ACL and he had another ACL. And what we did, the Court of Appeals referred to it as stacking, but we gave a separate minimum rating for both of the ACL repairs. That came up to 20%. We then said, well, Dr. Ansari's rating is 10%. That's below the minimum in the code, and we applied the code minimum instead.
Counselor, if I buy your argument, then if he gets enough multiple surgeries, he can get the same compensation as if he lost his whole leg, even though the final surgery may make his leg back to where it should have been at the time of the injury.
The administrative code only lists a few surgeries, knee surgeries, for which it sets minimums.
If he had 10 ACL repairs, we would pay 100%. So he could have enough of them to have the same amount as if he had 100% loss of his leg?
And that would be 10 of them. And we would pay compensation at 100% for that. And the reason that we do this, this so-called stacking issue, is the note in DWD 8211. Now, that note deals with backs. But what it says is if you have a back injury and you need a surgery, and then you have multiple surgeries at the same level. It was the intent of the people who wrote the code that a separate minimum rating be given for each procedure, a separate minimum rating. And then they set out an example where somebody has a laminectomy and a fusion and then a refusion, and they're five each, so it goes to 15%, even though the fusion was done twice and presumably was better than the first fusion that failed. And we said, well, this note applies to BACs, or it's attached to the part of the code dealing with BACs, but the structure of the rule is similar with BACs as it is to knees. That is, there is a list of surgeries and conditions, and then next to it there are disability percentages. And since the structure in 8211 dealing with, or I'm sorry, 102, I'm sorry, 8032 sub 11 dealing with BACs is similar to subsection 4 dealing with knees, you can use this note as an interpretive aid to determine what you're supposed to do with multiple knee surgeries. And we said, then you count all the knee surgeries. Now, Mr. Roy has argued that that note only applies to BACs. And he cites the rule of statutory construction that when something appears in one place but not in another, you assume the words mean something different. But the problem with that argument is this is a note we're talking about, not the actual language of the administrative code. The actual language of the administrative code is fairly consistent, fairly parallel in both subsection 4 and subsection 11. So if you take that note and say that only BACs get these add-ons or multiple disabilities, you're giving that note a substantive effect, which notes just aren't supposed to have.
Well, aren't you giving it a, I'm sorry, I guess I missed that. Aren't you giving it a substantive effect and saying it's to have the same weight as though it were written out there in the code, but it applies to any surgery that's listed there?
The code does not specifically say what happens when there are multiple surgeries. The commission believes that if you look at the way it's written without even looking at the note, because it's talking about a surgery in a minimum, that the most reasonable reading is just to give a credit for every surgery. Then you look at the note, and it is interpretive or explanatory and support for that interpretation. But we're not saying that it's the note itself that's the only basis for the add-on rule. We're saying the rule doesn't specifically say what happens when you have multiple surgeries, so we have to come up with some interpretation, and the note supports it. But it supports it for every surgery in the code, not just the back surgeries.
Do you rely on the Wilson case in
yes.
that argument? Tell me what that is.
The Wilson case is a case where there was a question about what the word malicious meant in a state statute. And the Court of Appeals looked to the drafting record from the Legislative Reference Bureau, and it said, and in the record it said, with respect to subsection 3, malicious means something, and I don't remember what it said. And the court said, well, you can take that same note, even though it's directed at subsection 3, and apply it to a different subsection in the statute, subsection 1, and that's what they did. And this is the idea that you can use these notes to have a more global effect, but if you use them to actually change the wording of the subsection at issue, then you're giving them a substantive effect.
What is the highest estimate in evidence?
The highest estimate in evidence is the 15% estimate that Dr. Ansari retracted and gave, and then he gave the 10% estimate.
Okay, and your ruling was 20%.
Right, and our ruling is based on the medical evidence that he had these two ACL surgeries. And we take that fact and we apply it to the minimums, and we say you can stack the minimums, so we come up with a 20%. And our position is that 102.18.1d really does not say that you have to base an award on a doctor's estimate. It just says if you do, and then if it's within 5% of the high and 5% of the low, it's reasonable. So to be honest, the commission's position is that we think that the reading that Mr. Roy is advancing effectively tries to invalidate the rule without really even any basis for doing it, because the rule just does not say that the commission can't base an award on a minimum in the code. And in fact, as I said, the Harnisch-Fager case and the Moen case, the Supreme Court said it was fine with respect to vision and hearing loss. And in those situations, doctors don't even give disability estimates.
Counselor, was there anything, if you know, when the Section 8032 minimums were being promulgated that set some of these minimums, because even with surgery that's, quote, successful under a doctor's terminology, the joint or the ligament, whatever is repaired, will never really be quite where it was to begin with?
There is something in the legislative history to that effect. I unfortunately only found out about it in the last week or so. There is, there are a transmittal when the rule was promulgated to the Rules Clearinghouse that has a list of reasons and rationale for the rule. Among those is exactly the point Justice Rogensack is making. That material, I got it from the agency. I tried to get it from the Historical Society on time, so it would be official, but it hasn't arrived yet.
Thank you.
Mr. Shampo, if I could, with respect to the evidence that is in the record, you've got Dr. Ansari's testimony, 15% with the first surgical procedure, and you have his testimony for 10% after the second surgical procedure, and they both were below the mandatory minimums if you added 10 plus 10. But the ALJ in this case, I recall when he stacked them, he stacked the 15 plus the 10 and came up with 25, and the hearings and appeals did not accept that and reduced it down to 20. And I just don't recall, what was the basis for that reduction?
Well, part of the basis for that and is that when we base awards on the minimums, we don't really like to go above the minimums, right? Because we want to stick within what the medical evidence is. Now, Mr. Roy, I think, probably could point to a case or two where we have. But the better practice when you're going to base an award on the minimum is to go with the minimum. And since Dr. Ansari said he got better, we didn't feel adding 5% above the minimum was justified based on the ACL repairs.
And if I can follow that question up, had the testimony come in inverse, let's say the testimony was 15% with the first surgery, but the knee actually got worse after the second, and let's say it was 20% after the second, the minimums would take you to 20. Well, that's not that case is not before. So I'm not
that case, we have addressed that case, and that is in the materials Mr. Roy has provided in his brief. That's the Manka case, and what happened there was the worker had a fusion in or a discectomy and fusion in her neck, and then another fusion, and the doctor said you get 10% plus 2% for pain, and we said no, you get 5% for each procedure. So we gave 15% as a basis, and then we tacked the 2% on two. And in the Manka case, then we increased the award to 17%. But again, I'm not going to say we've never not done this, but the better practice is to limit the use of the code provisions to that type of situation.
Thank you.
How many estimates do you normally, or let's say, how many estimates can you have in a case?
I don't want to make up a number, but typically you get a treating doctor or maybe a couple treating doctors to give an estimate because people treat with a number of doctors. They see a surgeon and a neurologist and a neurosurgeon and then a physiatrist afterward for recovery, and then the insurer goes out and hires an IME. So you might, in a typical case, get a number of disability estimates, and then these minimums don't really come into effect because somebody at least has hit the minimum. In this case, this is different because the treating surgeon gave this rating that was, because it was below the minimum, favorable to Mr. Roy, and I assume for tactical reasons he didn't get a, he felt he didn't need an IME, or maybe not for tactical reasons, he just felt he didn't need an IME. I'm out of time, but I would like to try and make one point very quickly, and that has to do with the argument that the rule is invalid because of the conflict with 102.18.1d. We don't think that the rule is invalid because of the conflict with 102.18.1d. We don't even see a conflict. But I think that issue raises the jurisdictional issue under 227.40, where if you're going to claim a rule is invalid because of a statutory conflict, you have to give notice to the Joint Committee for the Review of Administrative Rules. Mr. Roy didn't do that in this case. He argues he doesn't have to because it's a workers' comp case. But the section of the Administrative Procedure Act that deals with the applicability of the rules, 227.03 sub 2, says that rules under Chapter 102, that would be workers' comp rules, are subject to the Administrative Procedure Act, so he should have followed the procedure under 227.40. Now, I don't think this is a huge issue. Because obviously if you approve our interpretation of the rule as being a minimum, then there isn't any statutory conflict.
So generally 227 doesn't apply to 102 cases.
It does not apply to judicial review.
But 227.032 says that the provisions relating to rules under those statutes does apply to 102. That's
right.
Your interpretation or reading of it.
That's my reading of it, and that would make 227.40 apply, and that would mean you had to have this JCRAR notice.
Thank you, counsel.
I'd like to thank you all for your attention, and now I'm going to let Mr. Fortune talk.
All right. Mr. Fortune, you represent Glenn May.
That's correct, Your Honor. My name is Richard Fortune. I'm with the firm of Fortune and McGillis out of Racine, Wisconsin, and I represent the injured employee, Glenn May. I think what I'm going to do, because in a sense my part of this discussion is a continuation of Mr. Shampoo's, is just pick up with some of the concerns that the court has raised in the discussion so far this morning. One thing I think that may not be all that significant but is worth observing because Justice Butler did is, at the time of the first ACL repair, there was also a meniscectomy. That's why the ALJ found of 25%. But that kind of got lost in translation through the commission's treatment.
Is there a minimum set out for that procedure as well?
Yes, 5%.
5%.
So the two ACLs were 10% and the meniscectomy was 5%, and that's how we arrived at the 25%. I'd also like to briefly reference the background for the minimum assessments based upon surgical histories to which Judge Rogensack made a reference. There is a medical history to the provisions in Section 8032. What happened is the Advisory Council, which is the entity which advises the legislature with respect to changes in the workers' compensation statutes, had done a survey of the surgeons throughout the state to evaluate disabilities in industrial cases. And these minimum assessments of disability were a consequence of that survey. It's important to observe that to the degree that they fill in the evidence, so to speak, in a workers' compensation hearing, allowing for a finding of permanent disability premised upon the minimum alone without the assessment of a physician's opinion, as Mr. Roy suggests, it's important to note that they changed. In 1994, they changed in a couple of respects. Excuse me. They, among other things, they'd asked about carpal tunnel surgery cases. The results that the advisory council had gotten were so disparate that no minimum was judged or was assessed as a minimum in carpal tunnel surgeries because the surgeons who responded to the survey were not sufficiently, there was not a sufficient consensus among them. The consensus with respect to hip injuries changes or hip replacements changed. It used to be 50%. Because hip replacements have become so successful, it was reduced from 50% to 40%. Knee prostheses were 40%. Because they were being more and more performed and were less successful than was at first anticipated, they went from 40% to 50%. The point is that that this code provision, 8032 is a code provision, is a vital developing area of medicine. So to say that there is no medical evidence to support the minimums that are set out in 8032 is not exactly accurate. There is medical evidence, and the medical evidence comes from the physicians throughout the state of Wisconsin rather than a single assessment.
Counselor, I appreciate your input in this area. I guess what you're responding to is consistent with what I had recalled, was that it is the condition of the joint or whatever we're talking about here after the surgery, because here you're telling me that you used to get a 50% permanent partial for a hip replacement and now you get a 40. But it's not because you went through the surgery. It's because of the condition of your hip joint after the surgery.
correct?
Yes, it's that, and it's because the opinions of the surgeons throughout the state are such that this surgery is getting better.
Getting better, right.
People come out of this surgery and they can do more than they can. They can function better than they used to be able to function. Right. And so we're going to drop it a little bit.
But that doesn't mean, well, let me ask, does that mean, never mind, I'll withdraw my question.
Okay. I do want to then also mention the difference between the appellant and the respondent's position with respect to Pfister and Vogel. We agree that 102.18.1d is in response to Pfister and Vogel, but it doesn't do what Mr. Roy suggests it does. It doesn't codify Pfister and Vogel. It codifies and modifies Pfister and Vogel, and you can't read Pfister and Vogel without also reading Polson. Pfister and Vogel specifically says that it disavows the finding in Polson, which allowed a 5%, what it described as, the court described as a 5% leeway. It said there is no 5% leeway. Well, within a year of Pfister and Vogel, which was decided in January of 1979, by 1980, 102.18.1d came into existence. And what it did is it accepted Polson and it accepted Pfister and Vogel, and it created the presumption that we've been talking about earlier this morning. And that, I think, is the difference between Daimler-Chrysler's position on 102.18.1d and the respondent's position. What it did not do is it did not use the word shall. The legislature knows that if they want to create a mandate, all they would have had to do in 102.18.1d to do what Mr. Roy is suggesting is to say every decision shall not be greater than the greatest, lower than the lowest assessment of disability, or vary by more than 5%. In the Polson case, there's a discussion, there's a request by the applicant to have a tiebreaker opinion. And the Polson case discusses. The statute used to say that the department shall have a tiebreaker opinion, and then they changed it to may. In the same way, if the legislature had intended Pfister and Vogel to be codified by 102.18.1d, they would have said this shall be that decisions shall be within a 5% range, not greater than the greatest or lower than the lowest. I think one thing that's important to realize here in the court's history of decisions in workers' compensation cases is replete with this understanding, which is that this Chapter 102 of the Wisconsin statutes, this Workers' Compensation Act, is a socioeconomic balance that was created in 1911 to serve interests of employers and employees. And it does do that. And one of the ways it does that is it allows for an expeditious resolution of issues between injured workers and their employers. One of the ways that is brought about is by creating minimums, defined results, defined assessments of disability on the margins, on the periphery. So certain kinds of surgeries will be minimums. 102.42.2 provides that with some kinds of injuries, loss of an arm and a leg, both arms, both legs, the person is perm total. Now that employee can go back to work, but he or she is a statutory perm total. They're 100% disabled for workers' comp purposes, even though they may be back to work and working. So the point is that this scheme, what the court in Anderson refers to as a statutory covenant of interests of employers and employees being resolved by legislative effort, is serviced by the provisions of 8032 and specifically the Commission's interpretation of 8032.
Counsel, do the numbers that we have in 8032 and, you know, for hearing loss and sight and everything, are those numbers approved or go through the advisory committee?
They are, in specifically with respect to 8032, they were a consequence of a survey of the advisory council. And the participants were, I think, almost exclusively administrative law judges from the department.
And is this the kind of survey that you were talking about moments ago when you were saying that, the results have indicated certain types of surgeries have improved. For instance, hip replacements were reduced from 50% to 40%. Is that the kind
That's
of
correct,
surgery?
That's correct, right.
But you're still talking about, let's say, 40%. You're talking about then a scheduled minimum. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And so oftentimes, as we earlier discussed, you'll have doctors' testimonies saying, okay, that's the minimum, but here it wasn't such a good surgery or something, and so we're not talking about a 40%, we're talking about a 50% or a 55% because of greater loss of motion or
yes.
something like that.
Yes.
But what was set was, in the kind of uncontested case, that the worker is going to get whatever the minimum in the schedule is.
Right. Whatever that statutory minimum is, the worker is going to get. And in cases where there has been medical evidence for opinions above the minimum assessments, the commission has discussed it in those terms and have on occasion in some of the cases that are affixed to the briefs of counsel, there are discussions by the commission, well, this was a minimum of a 15%, but he's got a significant reduction in range of motion, or she has a significantly greater pain than is anticipated for this kind of surgery, and the doctors discuss that in their opinions. Those, though, go beyond the minimum assessments contained in 8032. That's correct.
And really the 8032 is almost like a you don't need a lawyer if you're satisfied with this amount. The employer is required to pay it and everybody moves on.
Yes,
but
right.
If you're not comfortable, then as your client wasn't, then you hire a lawyer and he looks at what opportunities you might have for an amount that exceeds the minimum.
Yes, that's right. As long as there are no other issues as to whether the condition arises out
sure,
of employment
right.
or things of that nature.
Just damages.
Yeah, and that's specifically the way in which it accommodates the expeditiousness that this socioeconomic balance in 1911 was supposed to create.
Right, I agree.
There is some discussion in the briefs regarding whether or not the system, the 8032 system, and our interpretation of it, the respondent's interpretation of it, violates 102.52.11, which is the portion. 102.52 is a statute that says every body part is allocated a certain number of weeks according to the joint. The farther you get from the center of the body, the fewer the number of weeks. So a shoulder and a hip is 500 weeks, a knee is 425, an elbow is 450, a hand is 400, fingers are less than the hand.
Kind of a personal sort of thing.
Yes, it is. It's kind of a breakdown of the person by joints, like a stick person. And the farther you get from the center of the body, the fewer the number of weeks. So the same percentage applied to that part of the body is a lesser amount of money. And that's the deal. You know, that's the scheme. That's the all-pervasive scheme. It was created in 1911, and there's no variation from that. It serves the purpose of both employers, who then are not facing claims for pain and suffering and some of these amorphous concepts that exist in actions at common law negligence when you're trying to quantify damages. You know, in workers' comp cases, there's no discovery, there's no pretrial practice, there's no motion practice. It's supposed to go bang, 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 and this is what it is. 8032 accommodates that purpose. There was some discussion in the briefs, and this goes in part to Justice Rogan Sock's observations about whether or not somebody who has 10 ACL repairs can have 100% disability to the knee, which is true. But by the wisdom of the surgeons in the state, that's a lot of disability. 10 ACLs is a lot of surgical intervention. It can never be more than 100.
Now, you know, I have difficulty lining up that comment with your comment to me before. And I think you and I agreed that the minimums are because that ACLU is never going to be as
right.
good as it was before you had the work-related injury.
There's been surgical intervention. It's not going to be the same.
That's right. And it's because of the condition of the ACLU, not because
ACL.
ACL. Yeah, not ACLU. I knew that was a Freudian slip. ACL, thank
just
you very much.
Just testing to see if we're listening.
In any case.
About the intervention of the ACLU.
No, right. Okay, so it's not because you had the surgery. It is because your ACL is not ever going to be just like it was before you had the work injury. Okay, so now I hear you saying you can stack it because you've had lots of surgeries. But if you've had lots of surgeries, that may or that may not relate to the condition of the ACL. I mean, in this case, the second surgery made his ACL stronger. He didn't have atrophy of the muscle, and he was able to use his knee. And the first one was apparently not as successful. So you're losing me a little bit. I thought we were on the same page, but now I'm not sure.
I'm not sure that I understand what you mean.
Okay. I thought the minimums were for the condition of the physical item. Here
yes.
we're talking about
yes,
ACL.
That's correct. Right.
Then you started saying, well, you can stack them because you had a lot of surgeries. But having a lot of surgeries is a procedure that the doctors may say after two ACL repairs, in their experience, the condition of the ACL may be 10% off what it was. Or they may say after two ACLs, in our general view of the matter, it may be 10%, it may be 20%. But the minimum that's in here is for the condition of the member, not for how many surgeries you have to put the member in that condition.
Well,
does that make any sense?
I think that the wisdom behind 8032 is that the collective wisdom of the surgeons in the state is that there is going to be this measure of disability just as a consequence of the surgical intervention.
Yes.
As a practical
right.
matter, if you get to 10 ACL repairs, you're probably 7 past the knee replacement anyway. So a surgeon is not likely, I think, to do 10 ACL repairs, continuing to repair a repair. I mean, eventually, I think, because there is a point at which there is diminishing functional return from any kind of surgical intervention, it just is not practical to consider someone who would have so great a measure of surgical history without simply having had a knee replacement.
Well, I understand that, but I think I'm still
maybe
not,
I'm missing your point.
Yeah, and my point is not being well stated clearly, because you and I were talking about the same thing at one point. I knew about the history that underlays 8032 when I asked your co-counsel that question. And it was my understanding that it was developed because if you hurt yourself and you have surgery, it's better than it would have been without the surgery, but your ACL is never like it was before the work-related injury. Okay.
Right.
So it goes to the condition of the ligament in this case.
The post-surgical condition.
That's exactly right. But I never knew of any history that said every time you have a surgery, the condition of the ligament gets worse and worse and worse, which is what you'd have to have if you're going to stack it and still base the minimums on the condition of the member, the ligament here we're talking about. Is that any clear?
You're understanding it, and that is. I am saying that each surgical intervention is going to produce some reduced measure of function or some reduced, in some respect, with respect to ranges of motion or pain or something. There will be, I mean, the second surgery wouldn't have been done if the first surgery was not to some degree unsuccessful.
Sure.
And presumably the second surgery improves on the first post-surgical condition,
yeah.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
But it's worse, certainly it's worse than before any surgeries at all and any injury at all.
Okay. All right.
May I ask a question, Chief?
Justice Brasser.
In 8032-4, the bottom item is that anterior cruciate ligament repair minimum of 10%. When you go up the list, there are all these other figures. For example, I can't even pronounce it. The first one is 40%.
For an ankylosis?
Yes. Does every surgery add to the 40%? Are we talking about something special to this last item that has the word repair in it? Or does every surgery add to every one of these?
Ankylosis is effectively a fusion of the joint, and those assessments of disability under 8032 are pretty high. But they're high because the joint itself has been effectively fused, and so there's significant loss of range of motion. If there were an injury that produced a, and our interpretation of 8032 is this, if there were an injury that produced an ankylosis, and somebody had it, and therefore an 80% minimum at the joint for that ankylosis, and then subsequently had a second injury, and that second injury produced the need for a ACL repair, if it were feasible to do that on someone who's already fused the joint. I don't know if it is or not, medically speaking. But our argument would be then for that second surgery, there would have to be an additional 10% paid as a result of the ACL repair, if you can repair an ACL on a knee which is already fused.
And that's essentially what the ALJ did in this case. But you're not arguing that we should go back to the ALJ's position. Is that correct?
No, I think the issues at stake here are larger than that.
All right.
Thank you for your attention.
So you're supporting the decision of Lurk?
I'm sorry?
You're supporting Lurk's decision?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Thank you.
Counsel?
First of all, to respond to the counsel for the commission's argument that Section 102.18.1d only applies to cases outside of those involving administrative code minimums, I draw the court's attention to the very first two words of that statute. It says, any award. There are no exceptions. With respect to counsel's
indication. Any award made by a practitioner.
Actually, when they refer to award, Your Honor, they're talking about the awards of the commission.
Any award which falls within a range of 5% of the highest or lowest estimate of permanent partial disability made by a practitioner. So the award would be an award made by the department. But what kind of award? Award of a percentage of disability made by a practitioner, right? So I grant you, award is an award made by the department, but what kind? Well, then just follow the rest of the sentence. An award with a range of 5% of the highest or lowest estimate of permanent partial disability made by a practitioner. It doesn't say anything about an award based on the minimum percentage in the scheduled injury where there isn't any doctor's report.
You are correct, Your Honor. This basically says any award which falls within a range of 5% of the highest and lowest, etc. And the award that the commission entered in this case does not fit that.
What are you doing with the words made by a practitioner then in your interpretation?
That's right. I mean, it's within 5% of the highest or lowest estimate of permanent partial disability made by a practitioner, which is an evidence. And that's very important language. That's the language we're relying upon. The award in this case does not fall within that range.
Is it your position, if I'm an injured employee and I have a spinal fusion and it's 10%, I don't know what fusions are now, I feel okay and I just don't want to get involved in litigation. Is it your position that in order to get an award of compensation that I have to go out and hire a doctor to give me more than the minimum and then file a report?
It's my position that you do not need to have the medical support to make your claim. And since the doctor took the time to do surgery on you, in most cases that doctor will see it as part of his job to award or assess permanent partial disability.
Okay. What about hearing loss?
That's a great question. I wanted to come to that question next. There is absolutely nothing in this court's decision in Harnisch-Fager, in Employers Mutual, and in Moen, nor is there anything in the statute, nor is there anything in the administrative code, which says that you do not need a medical opinion for an award in hearing loss or in vision. You do need a medical opinion.
You do need a medical opinion, but the doctor doesn't give a percentage of disability. Okay. In a hearing loss, they give what loss of decibel level. And then whatever the loss of decibel level is, you take that, you plug it into the schedule, and that's how many weeks of disability you get.
With all due respect, Your Honor, I disagree with you.
Okay, I might be
wrong. The reason why I disagree with you is that it is not unusual for an audiogram to come back And for a physician to look at that audiogram and say either, one, it is not related to the employment, or two, it's partially related to the employment.
Now you're dealing with causation.
And, now we're dealing with medical evidence as to what is the amount of permanent partial disability that arises from that audiogram that arises from the employment.
If you're over 93 decibels, if the doctor's report doesn't say anything about percentage of disability, the doctor's report says 94 decibel loss, what are you going to get?
Well, then you look to the administrative code, and the administrative code has the calculations that allow you to, but you still need the doctor's opinion that says that that amount of decibel loss arises out of the employment.
Sure, yeah.
And in fact,
my question presupposes, and I forgive me for not putting that, presupposes a work-related injury. So I'm not talking about causation here. I'm talking about I understood you to suggest that there always has to be a doctor with a percentage of disability or practitioner report. And I'm saying that I'm just making the point, in hearing loss, you don't have doctor's reports with percentages of disability.
You still need the medical opinion that the percentage of disability arises out of the employment in hearing loss and vision cases. They may not state it as such.
You need causation. I totally agree, but that's not my point. But I agree with you. You need causation.
And I'll draw the Court's attention to DWD 80.25 subsection 5, which states that the diagnosis of occupational hearing loss is based upon the occupational medical history, the results of the audiological and audiometric examinations, and their evaluation. You'll see similar language in the Vision Administration Code. A doctor is part of the process, and medical evidence is necessary. I agree with Dr. Rogensack that what the defendants are trying to do is give a substantive effect. I guess I'm out of time, huh?
No, that we're amused that you referred to a justice as doctor. But it's okay.
Oh, well, yeah.
And I have a JD.
I just gave you a new degree.
Well, I have one. I have a doctor of jurisprudence, so you're okay.
That's
what your reference was.
And I've got the red light here, so I guess I need to stop unless you'd let me to give a few more points.
Can you finish his answer, Chief?
If you remember what you were saying, complete the sentence.
I don't recall what sentence I was on at the time that the red light went on.
Thank you
very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Fortune. Thank you, Mr. Shampoo. Thank you, Mr. Rowey, for your arguments on the second workers' compensation case that we have this month. That concludes our hearing in 05-APO-544, Chrysler v. Lerp. And the Court will convene in closed conference in the conference room at 3:15. Thank you. We are adjourned.